Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend podcast for the weekend of June 27th, 2014. Sometimes you think you know something, you're pretty sure of it, but then uncertainty kind of clips you behind the knees. Like this week, we learned the economy shrank by 2.9% in the first quarter of the year, which, what? Aren't we supposed to be growing? How do you feel secure in that? Or build a path forward for your family? I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend. This show is all about context and conversation, how that uncertainty, or whatever the big story of the week is, affects you, the why behind it, and what's next. And we want you to be a part of it. Come talk to us online at marketplaceweekend.org. We're incorporating what you say into the show. This week, we're going to talk about what it means to be middle class right now, plus the more creative stuff listeners have done to get by. But first, here's your week in 20 seconds.
Sunni militants from ISIS have reportedly seized the country's largest oil refinery in the town of Baiji.
I'm announcing that we have filed a securities fraud complaint against Barclays, arising from the operation of Barclays' dark pool.
GDP fell much more than initially estimated.
LeBron James has officially decided to opt out of his contract.
The CEO of Aereo has come out and said, we're not dead yet.
Not dead yet, huh? That last clip you heard, we're going to go a little deeper on that story. Aereo, the company that used teeny antennas to grab TV signals that show them on your computer, lost at the Supreme Court. The court said, nope, you're just showing copyrighted content without paying for it. But here's the thing. This decision could make things a little unclear for the next company that wants to show you live TV on your phone, your tablet, or your laptop. We've got Zach Seward with us. He's a senior editor at Quartz. Hi, Zach.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Aereo's toast?
Aereo is done. They put out a statement that said their work is still in progress, but Aereo as we know it is not surviving.
Put this in context for us. What does this decision mean for how TV is going to evolve in the future?
It probably makes it more difficult for new and innovative ways of getting and watching television to emerge, because those startups are now going to have to be much more careful about whether what they're doing is violating the same copyright law that Aereo was found to be violating. And I think the upshot of the Supreme Court's ruling is that it's going to be slower still to see real innovation happen in TV.
You wrote about the distinction between Aereo itself and the cloud. And I think one of the questions that a lot of consumers have is, what does this mean for cloud companies going forward? Do we know yet?
You know, the title of the case is officially ABC v. Aereo, but I think in a way it would have been better and attracted more interest if it were ABC v. the cloud. And that's what really was on trial here, because who really cares about Aereo specifically and whether it survives? It's really a small startup, but it's the concept behind it which makes use of the cloud that is actually important.
Explain to me what cloud companies were so worried about.
Well, the allegation was that in part because of Aereo's technology, which makes use of the internet and cloud storage technology, that that's what turned what it does into a copyright violation, different from just recording a TV program on your own DVR at home. And so if that's a copyright violation in Aereo's case, it was hard to see why that wouldn't also be a copyright violation in a lot of other cases.
What other companies are waiting in the wings to take over this niche?
You know, two ways to think of it. There are a lot of other small startups similar to Aereo, Nimble TV for one, that kind of do similar things and will try to incrementally innovate on the way people get television. And then there are big technology companies like Dish Network and then some big tech behemoths like Apple that are likely to enter the what you might call internet TV space, which is to say that trying to deliver pretty traditional television except over the internet where it can get a lot better and more enjoyable to watch.
All right, man, what do you do?
Well, I was once a cord cutter, maybe now 2-3 years ago, and now I'm the exact opposite. You know, I say it's for my job, but you know, I have to make sure I pay for TV and have HBO and Showtime and plus Netflix, plus Hulu, all that. So what do? I think what most people do is you're a little stuck right now. Television is still a largely very expensive and in the hands of a few cable companies.
Zach Seward, senior editor at Quartz, thanks a lot.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We want to keep talking about Aereo and some other stories, and it's the weekend, so let's go have brunch. So we're out having brunch at La Noche de Figaro in downtown L.A., and I've got two guests with me, Andrea Chang from the L.A. Times and Ken Bensinger from BuzzFeed. Hey, guys.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Hey there.
I'm kind of curious. How do you guys watch TV?
I still have a cable subscription. I have a big TV, a Samsung, and I still have Time Warner, and I watch most of my TV that way. I have a Roku, so I'll sometimes watch Amazon Prime Instant stuff through that as well. So I think I do a little bit of everything.
She's going for the record, folks. She's going to break the record of name brand dropped in one sentence.
No, I...
Can we just go through that? Time Warner, Samsung, Amazon, Roku, Hulu.
They own you. Right. True. Well, this is the
sign
of
being... She's like a NASCAR team member.
No. This is the sign of being like a tech reporter who in the past, if you'd asked me a few years ago, I'd say I just watch TV.
I watch everything on DVR because I have children. So nothing... Live doesn't exist for me. Like, everything has to be recorded and watched later. I've been thinking about the Aereo thing because my takeaway from it was, is there some kind of like fundamentally sneaky about their entire business model?
Yes.
Like, from the face of it, it was like, oh, we're going to outsmart them by like... Instead of just using one big antenna, like getting a crap load of antennas and pretending that changes the nature of things.
That's exactly right. I mean, it was exploiting a loophole that existed, and they thought they could get away with it with these dime-sized antennas. And by giving every single person their own antenna, they were saying, well, this is private use. It's not public.
I don't know. I read about the ruling, and I thought, God, you know, I'm not at all surprised about this. And I like, if I've been asked to invest in a company that's fundamental design was, we're going to outsmart the law by finding a loophole, I feel like I was investing in Bitcoin or something. Like, I don't, things that like have a very strong glass ceiling and a very high, you know, a very wet cardboard bottom.
What's gonna happen to Dov Charney?
Right now, Dov Charney, the founder and sort of ex-CEO now of American Apparel, is fighting his recent termination. Even though he has been unanimously voted out by his own board.
You've covered him for a long time, though, yeah?
Yes, I did cover him quite a bit, and that was when American Apparel was doing very poorly and when his sexual harassment lawsuits had been filed against him. This was in 2011.
Have you talked to him lately?
Yes, I have.
What does he say?
Generally speaking, he was not ready to let go of American Apparel.
So you would
how
think...
How many naked pictures?
How many times did Dov Charney...
Yeah.
Get busted for doing something dumb and inappropriate with women.
Actually, you know, the other day he was very upset because we ran a blog post online with some details of my interactions with him over the last few years. And when I talked to him on the phone afterwards, he felt like we were painting an unfair portrayal of him. And when I said, well, what about this is unfair? He says, well, you called me an unpredictable executive. And I'm like, wait, that's your big issue? He's like, I don't like the word unpredictable. I'm like, but you realize that the rest of that story talked about you humping a chair in front of me, talked about you sending naked photos of women to me. And at that point he said, but those things are, I did. I'm not ashamed to say that I did those things. He's like, but calling me unpredictable, that's a characterization of me that I don't believe in.
Yeah, he's like, I'm predictably going to be chasing girls.
Right.
And like, you can count on that.
And so don't say it's unpredictable.
I want to talk about this story you did that blew my mind about the birth of soccer in the U.S.
Yeah, his name is Chuck.
His name is
Chuck Blazer?
Chuck Blazer, yeah.
Explain who Chuck Blazer is.
Chuck Blazer is a soccer dad, but he's like for many years, was probably the most powerful soccer dad in the entire world. And he's got this genius for seeing opportunity when others don't. And what he saw was that this sport is big in the rest of the world. It's going to be big in the U.S. eventually. And he, in the space of a very, very few years, went from shuttling his kid to practice to becoming one of the 24 most powerful soccer people in the world.
How do you make so much money?
By being a really fierce negotiator with himself. He, in 1990, took over this organization called, ready for it, CONCACAF.
Mm-hmm.
That's a beautiful...
I've learned that one over the past few weeks.
Well, it's been a good few weeks for the CONCACAF. Yeah. They're doing really well in the World Cup. But CONCACAF is the soccer organization that runs soccer from Panama all the way through to Canada, including the U.S. and Mexico and the Caribbean. And through some political savvy, he took over this organization, essentially. And when he took over, the first thing he did is wrote a contract for himself. And the contract said, I get 10% of everything.
Like, no matter what, in perpetuity, I got this?
Including, like, hot dog sales, right?
Everything that came in the door. And so he ends up making about $22 million from soccer.
We're in the wrong line of work.
We really are. We should run. So someone was speculating the thing we should do is get into, like, what's the next sport that's big in the rest of the world that's not big here? I was thinking badminton, you know?
Yeah.
Table tennis?
Cricket? Too old?
Lacrosse?
Cricket? Why not?
Well, what I loved, I mean, I loved a lot of
lacrosse, it's way too late, sorry.
Yeah, no, I was...
The Iroquois have you.
Well, what I was going to say is, I loved your story, and I just felt like Blazer was such a perfect character, not only with his name, Chuck Blazer, but the way he looked, and you guys did a great job of displaying all these photos of him. I loved how you said that, you know, he looks like Santa Claus, and you have this great paragraph
like
about
Jeremiah Johnson, mountain man kind of
That's
situation.
Good. Unruly beard, yeah. But he
I mean, grotesque is another word that has been used. I didn't use it.
I'm not touching that, man.
But he is...
Andrea Chang and Ken Bensinger, thank you guys so much.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thanks.
We've all done it. It's way past your bedtime, and maybe you find yourself shopping online, and then you buy that thing. You know, the one that makes you say, I can't believe I bought that. On MarketplaceWeekend.org, we've opened up our own museum of regret, and we want to add yours. Visit the site, check out our Tumblr, and leave us a story and picture of your own regretful purchase. Each week, we're going to pick our favorite entry and feature it here on the show. To get the ball rolling, here's mine. It's a lithograph, I think, a big canvas print of a panda holding six shooters on a rainbow backdrop. It came from the internet, of course. There might have been some wine involved. That's all I'm saying. This week online, we asked you to tell us about what you've done to get by that was maybe, well, not your day job, sometimes even a little outside the lines. Carla wrote in from Indianapolis. Her family got hit pretty hard by the recession. She had to cut back on food costs, meaning no more fresh vegetables or meat from the local farmers. So Carla told one of the farmers her budget problems, and he came up with this.
Where I would work every Saturday at the farmer's market, and in exchange for that, I would get my food share. Over the winter, this past winter, I got all my meat as part of my working the winter market.
We got Carla's story from our conversation over at MarketplaceWeekend.org, where we asked what surprising things you've done to make ends meet. We're calling these stories the gray economy. Ron Lieber is the Your Money columnist at the New York Times, and he joins me to talk about them. Hey, Ron.
Hello.
What do you think about this concept of the gray economy? You know, do you see people doing this when times are tough?
I think it happens all the time. I think it happens more than we know. I think people don't always talk about it. And I think there is a vast and broad definition of gray and what constitutes a side gig. So it doesn't surprise me at all that you found lots of people doing it in a ton of different ways.
Janice is a teacher at a school on the East Coast, a boarding school. There is a big confluence of high-priced commodities, education, also low-priced stuff. She found an interesting way to substitute her income. Let's listen to that.
Hi, my name is Janice, and I'm a teacher at a boarding school here on the East Coast. At the end of every year, many of our students toss their unwanted textbooks into the dumpster, and every year I go dumpster diving to retrieve those books. At first, I would be a good Samaritan and take the books to Goodwill to be donated. But when Goodwill wouldn't accept some of them, I began selling them on Amazon. I bring in between $500 to $1,000 each summer. I live frugally throughout the year, so I spend the money on personal things for myself. With ebooks becoming so popular, my business will take a hit. They're good for the planet, but bad for my business.
That was Janice's story as read by a Marketplace employee. And Ron, what do you take away from that?
Well, there's a couple things I love about this. The first one is the recognition that there are always people out there who value their belongings and are less responsible with them than you are. You know, it's a well-known fact that if you go roaming around college campuses on exactly the right day of the year, i.e. the day that the dorms close, there will be all sorts of treasures both in those rooms that are left behind if you can find your way into those buildings or out on the curb. And it's a great opportunity to pick things up on the cheap and then go ahead and resell them. But the other thing that's cool about what she's doing is she seems to be disciplined about her spending and thinking about it throughout the year. And so for 9 months of the year, she just concentrates on her needs. And then she goes out and collects all of these things and resells them. And at that point, she allows herself to indulge in the wants with that extra $500 to $1,000 that she picks up.
Let's get to Vice. I'm putting that in with a smile on my face. Our senior producer is going to tell his story, and it, well, let's just let it unfold.
My name is Dan Semitovich. I'm the senior producer for Marketplace Weekend. When I first started out in radio, it was at a station in Florida, and I started off as a part-time board operator and a very part-time producer. And that, surprisingly, does not pay a lot of money. My brother was working at the local casino as a poker dealer as a means to pay for law school. So one day I go to visit him and see what he does and just have some fun, went out with some friends, sit down at a poker table and find that I'm actually pretty good at it. I won. I didn't really know what I was doing, but I won. I kind of picked up the game fairly quickly. I go back the next week and I win again, same results. A few months later, I'm making more playing poker than I am working in public radio. It was a fad, it was a phase, and it was a fun one. You know, it was action, it was the schlub wearing the sunglasses that anybody could be. And now for a short time in a small place, I was that schlub.
All right, Ron, I am so into this concept of people taking stuff that, hey, it turns out they're pretty good at, and making some money on.
Well, two things about this. First of all, we don't know exactly how long Dan was doing this. So I would ask the same question of him that I ask of people who do very well picking stocks, which is another form of gambling. And the question I have for them is, how do you know whether you are lucky or whether you are smart? The other thing I would ask about this is, are you thinking about your downside risk here? Because it's one thing to go dumpster diving and not find very many good textbooks because people are all buying ebooks now. It's quite another to go to the poker tables and actually end up down a couple thousand dollars.
Yeah, that's the real downside of this. So I guess the question anybody should ask themselves before they start doing something like this is, what could I lose?
What can I afford to lose?
Ron Lieber is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times. Ron, thank you so much.
Good to be here.
For next week, we want to know about the fine print. What did those little words do? Trip you up? Maybe help you out? Join our conversation at marketplaceweekend.org or on Twitter at MarketplaceWKND. We want you to be a part of the show. Here at Marketplace, we like to talk to each other about lots of stuff. Sports, the economy, food. I like food. How about you, Kai?
I like food.
Yeah?
Food's good.
Pecan pie.
Pecan. It's a pecan. We're not doing this again.
I'm tossing this one out at you.
All right.
The thing that is a computer image, like a picture that moves.
Are you kidding me? It is. And you know what I love about this is that you secretly agree with me, but will not do so in public. It's a GIF. G-I-F. GIF as in the peanut butter. And what I love about this, actually, so Lizzie and I go back and forth on Twitter a lot. And one day I went out on Twitter and in honest spirit of wanting to know something, I said, so G-I-F, is it GIF the peanut butter or is it GIF? And you came back with one of your totally classic, okay.
Okay.
And you know what? I was like, oh man, first of all, she thinks I'm a moron. And second of all, I'm wrong. And it turns out I'm right. The inventor of the format says GIF.
That's great. My show's twice as long as yours. And this is going to be
twice as long
how
as
we do it on Marketplace Weekend, baby.
Seriously? If I hear you say GIF, I will write a heated letter to the editor.
Please do that.
That
would be great.
I will. And
I'll look
fact,
for your comments.
I expect to be included in your mailbag.
Kai can write us. You guys can. You can do it on our website. That's marketplaceweekend.org. Or get at us on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. And, you know, tell us how you pronounce pecan pie or GIF.
GIF.
We'll be right back.
Everybody has one, a moment or a story when money changed your life. Having it, not having it, maybe the first time you made some. This week, writer and editor Anna Holmes on money, fairness, and living down your demons.
I'm Anna Holmes, and I'm a writer in New York City and the editor of the recent book, The Book of Jezebel, based on the website I created in 2007. It was 2008, and I was sitting in the Brooklyn home office of my longtime accountant, who informed me that I had, for the first time in my 15-year career as an editor and writer, made over $100,000 in a year. Roughly $102,354.72. The six-figure mark filled me with pride, but it was short-lived. I didn't have much to show for it, other than a new outfit, or three, and maybe a couple of fancier dinners than I was accustomed to enjoying. For two, it was, I quickly realized somewhat guiltily, the first time I'd ever made more money than either of my parents. I grew up in a lower middle class household in an affluent college town in Northern California. To say that money was a stressor in the lives of my parents and in my own life would be the truth, but not the whole truth. My younger sister and I never went without. Our parents found the funds to buy us new clothes, new school supplies, take us on camping trips, and once, when I was 15, send me to visit a friend in Australia. We ate well, and for the most part, we slept well too. Even so, the financial stresses that my parents endured throughout my childhood felt personal and arbitrarily punitive. What with all the other kids and their trips to Tahoe and shiny new BMW sedans, and their apparent ignorance of any sort of existence that would complicate their lives or keep them out of the trendiest clothes and away from the most sought-after vacation destinations. Other kids' parents, I suspected, did not so much worry about money, did not fret as to whether they'd be able to make the mortgage payment that month, or whether the cherry red Chevrolet Nova was, as suspected, on its last legs, or how in God's name they were going to pay for their children's eventual college educations. My parents' financial insecurities made me feel impotent and terrified, and then, as I got older, they made me angry and determined, at which point I vowed that I would avenge some of the bad choices they had made and circumstances they had endured by growing up to become a wealthy adult, thereby ensuring that they would never have to worry about money again. I would pay off my mom's house and buy my father a bungalow in nearby Berkeley, plus the Chevy Suburban he'd always wanted. They would, through me, obtain a status that they had not been able to attain otherwise. And when people looked at them, they would not see a struggling single mom or a soft-spoken, middle-aged African-American male. They would see two loving, intelligent, passionate, authentic human beings. And maybe, just maybe, my parents would be karmically rewarded for it. What I didn't know then was that my parents' supposed humiliations were also, mostly, my own, and that six-figure salaries did not make up for the petty jealousies and resentments that come from living in a sexist world, a racist world, or a capitalist world, which is to say, an often unfair world. What I didn't know then was that more money, a little or perhaps even a lot of it, wouldn't profoundly change our narratives, wouldn't bestow upon me or those to whom I was related the respect and rewards I believed were our due, if not our birthright. It would not make my parents any prouder of me, and, as was made perfectly clear as I grew older and the size of my annual salary increased, it certainly wouldn't allow me to pay off that mortgage or buy that Berkeley bungalow. The only thing that my making more money than my predecessors symbolized, in fact, was that my parents had not failed but succeeded, triumphed in their efforts to give me access to the experiences and educations that might lead to the sort of professional and personal rewards they had dreamed of. That really was all they'd ever wanted to do.
Anna Holmes is a writer and editor in New York. Tell us your money story at marketplaceweekend.org. Here's a question. Do you still call yourself middle class?
Despite the fact that our economy has grown, and those of us at the very top have done very well, the average wage, the average income hasn't gone up for 15 years in any meaningful way.
Well, that's President Obama, of course, at this week's White House Summit on Working Families, you know, when politicians haul a few real people up on stage. It got us thinking about what it means to be in the middle right now. Wall Street's watching that, too, when the monthly jobs report comes out Thursday. Who's hiring, for how much, and what kind of life does that mean you can afford to build? To put that in context, we drove out to Glendora, California, a suburb of L.A., to meet a woman who wrote us about it. The stucco bungalows here all have the same floor plan. There are basketball hoops, bougainvillea, kids' toys in the driveways.
Hi.
Hey.
Hey, I'm Lizzie.
Hi, Lizzie. I'm Heather.
Hey, it's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Heather Moore is 33 and teaches 11th grade history. Her husband, Michael, is a computer programmer and stay-at-home dad to 4-year-old April. Heather's 7 months pregnant and sipping lots of water in the heat. Together, they live on about $82,000 a year, just over Glendora's median income.
Why do you feel like you're solidly in the middle?
We have a very suburban lifestyle. We are not struggling, but we are still concerned about money.
Heather says being in the middle is a balance of needs and wants.
Oh, yeah. My uncle has this great line. As long as you have everything you need and a little of what you want, then that's essentially a good life. And that's sort of where I feel we are today. We can afford to paint our house and save up a little for new carpet.
Do you guys have debt that you worry about?
No. We both, Michael and I, have a college education with no debt left over. That was a tremendous gift that my family was able to give us. That's the gift I want to give my children. That's my priority when it comes to saving, is to give them a college education that's debt-free. And if I put off retirement a few years, then so be it. Like, I can't think of a better reason to do it.
Do you think you could be middle class if your parents weren't?
That's a really good question. I think it would be a much, much harder struggle. I think clawing up is harder than maintaining, I guess you could say.
Heather took us on a tour of her house, the room they're painting for the baby, her backyard tomato plants.
Not to get too metaphorical on you, but you actually have a white picket fence.
Yeah, my students kind of tease me. They say that all I need is a dog, and then I have the perfect suburban lifestyle, my two kids and my house, my white picket fence. Of course, the white picket fence is around the pool filter, and it's sort of falling apart, but there you go.
When I see that sort of thing, and I do, I travel a lot for my job around to different communities, and I see communities, even sometimes new ones, that look like the community that I grew up in. But to me, that's like watching a black and white television show.
Jason DePinto is a Navy chaplain based in San Diego.
It doesn't bother me. It feels like there's a distance between my reality and that reality.
He calls himself borderline middle class. He's 2 years older than Heather and makes about $20,000 less. Do you want to buy a house?
I would love to buy a house. You know, I tried doing some of the online searches and walking around. I see for sale signs here and there, but you can never tell how much the house is going for. But in talking to friends who are realtors and looking at some of the online resources, I know that there is no way as a single wage earner that I could afford to purchase a house, even in what's often considered the most affordable of the beach communities there in San Diego.
You served in the Navy. You have been deployed to Afghanistan. Doesn't it seem like you're the exact person for whom these things should be available?
In some ways, that's exactly right. I mean, I have a pretty steady job. I have great benefits. You know, I have the possibility of promotion and greater responsibility, things like the GI Bill. So, yeah, you'd think that if there was a middle class to be had, it would be available to folks like me. But I think that when I talk to my friends and when I talk to my peers, I think we were very affected by the last 4 or 5 years. And I think that what it means for us to be secure is very different than what it was when we grew up.
We're 5 years out from the Great Recession. The economy is getting better. Why doesn't it feel like that?
That's a great question. You know, when I think about why it still feels bad, I think about my grandparents. You know, when I grew up in the 80s, they used to wash and fold the aluminum foil. And they used to unwrap gifts so that they could save the wrapping paper. And I remember thinking that was crazy. Nobody needed to do that. There was absolutely no reason to hold on to aluminum foil. But they did it because it had become a habit formed out of their experience in the Great Depression and growing up during the Second World War. And I think in some ways, my generation has had a similar experience with the Great Recession, with the global war on terror, and all the things that have happened in our lives that have created a bigger sense of risk and uncertainty. All of that has led us to a place where, even as the economy begins to recover and gain some strength, we've held on to these hesitancies. We've held on to these worries, and they've really affected our life and our outlook.
And maybe outlook is the key. Calling yourself middle class is almost as much about aspiration as income. Does mobility seem possible? Is there a chance for your kids to do better than you did? There's some data on that. So let's do the weekend number. Our number is 44 for 44% of Americans. That's how many of us say we're in the middle class, according to a recent Pew poll. And here's where that sense of risk Jason talks about kicks in. 5 years ago, it was 53%. So even as the economy improves, a lot of Americans in the middle just don't feel secure. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
Make it stop!
This is Tech in Real Life.
Marketplace tech host Ben Johnson is our guide to where tech crosses over, IRL, in real life. Like, when you're trying to get a Wi-Fi signal somewhere, you might be able to do that soon in New York from a payphone. Ben and I wanted to figure out how this thing might work, so we sent him to a phone. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Lizzie.
How are you?
I'm good. I found a working payphone. I won't say that it smells amazing. And I just tried to reach into the, coin return.
Yeah, we can barely hear you, so I'm going to come meet you, all right?
All right, sounds good. We'll talk to you in a few.
Okay, see you soon. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Lizzie.
So now we're at the payphone.
Yes.
Payphones, there
pay
are two.
Payphones, yep, one of them doesn't work.
These are not the shiniest, newest-looking payphones in the world. Not gonna lie.
No, they're not. There's some streaky liquid stuff. It's dark in here.
Got a little New York City love on these.
Yeah.
So, how many of these are there in the city, and what's the idea behind turning some of these into Wi-Fi hotspots? How many would get turned into hotspots?
Okay, so the idea here is that the city has about 7,300 payphone kiosks like this one around the city in all five boroughs. And the city wants to turn all of them into Wi-Fi hotspots. And then once those are turned into Wi-Fi hotspots, actually build more kiosks like these so that they get up to 10,000.
How do you do that?
Well, I mean, a lot of the infrastructure is pretty much already in the street, right?
Like,
I mean,
it's under
we're standing
us?
Yeah, it's under us. So, like, we're standing on a street, there's internet being delivered to this building next to us on Lexington Ave. There's internet being delivered to these apartments here, the businesses. So basically the infrastructure is already here. It would just take a company that provides internet already to actually hook up to the kiosks and put in a Wi-Fi router.
You said a key word there, company. Who pays to do this? A company, the city, a taxpayer like me?
It's a very interesting question. Right now, there are three companies that manage all of the payphone kiosks in the city. Their contracts are about to expire, hence this idea of turning them into Wi-Fi hotspots. It's a situation where the city believes that there's a lot of revenue to be had. If you look on the outside of these kiosks, I mean, there's an ad for like a show on HGTV on this side of the kiosk. There's a watch advertisement. There's a lot of ads that go on these kiosks, right? So the city thinks it can make about $17 million a year in revenue from whatever company takes this up.
$17 million.
They obviously need to partner with a developer and with a telecom to actually hook these things up. But once they do, there's a lot of revenue that would be driven from digital advertising that could be part of the kiosks. They might have actual like phone charging stations that are part of the kiosks, and they might charge, you know, a quarter for that, just like you might put it into the payphone. So there are some revenue stream possibilities there, and not unlike the internet itself, all driven by ads.
Are any other cities doing anything like this?
There are cities outside of the U.S. that are doing stuff like this. Osaka, Japan actually has a lot of Wi-Fi throughout the city that's free for its citizens. Geneva has done this. Paris has done this. There aren't really a lot of examples of cities that have blanket Wi-Fi, but they are turning up these hotspots around cities, mostly overseas.
There is
what's known as sort of a technology gap in the country, where sure. there are people who've got access to it and people who don't. When you think about having hotspots in a city like New York, does that help bridge it at all? Or are they just putting Wi-Fi in a place where a lot of people already have Wi-Fi?
I think that this is a good question. I don't think that this particular plan is going to move the needle when it comes to providing Wi-Fi to people who really need internet access and can't get it now. I think that what this will do is it's an incremental change for Wi-Fi around the city generally. I mean, just like you dip into a Starbucks to look at your maps or check your email. So I think it actually will make a noticeable change in the city generally, but in terms of the technology gap, I think that's a big question.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech, thank you for showing us some tech in real life.
Yeah, thanks, Lizzie.
Money's everywhere, and then sometimes, suddenly, it's not. And the thing you thought would pay off, or even be your salvation, goes sideways. This story is about how that can happen anywhere. Down in the southern New Mexico desert, 4 years ago, there was kind of a birthday.
It is today the birth of commercial space travel.
You know that voice. That's Richard Branson, the billionaire behind Virgin Records, Virgin Mobile, Virgin Atlantic. He was christening Virgin Galactic, promising tourists a 2.5-hour flight to space for $250,000 a pop. The operation set up shop outside Las Cruces at a place called Spaceport America.
It's really sort of an amazing thing to find in the middle of the desert.
Josh Wheeler wrote about it for BuzzFeed.
It rises up out of the desert almost from ground level on the south side and then opens up into this giant 3-story glass wall with a huge runway coming out of it on the other side. It's really sort of a beautiful building to find out in the middle of the desert.
People in this area, when they heard about this idea, they really were excited about it, and not just from an economic development standpoint.
That's Fred Martino, the director of content at the public radio station KRWG in Las Cruces.
The idea that they would live in the place where space travel would be possible, that was really an exciting idea.
So was what the spaceport could bring with it. In a state where almost 30% of children live in poverty, New Mexico would front the money for the spaceport, and Virgin would pay the rent and bring big spending space tourists, money and jobs, plus a chance to be part of something kind of magical. Again, Josh Wheeler.
As a young kid growing up in New Mexico, it was one of those sort of dreamy ideas that you have when you're out in the desert staring up at the stars. And then it seemed like something that people were actually going to try and make a reality, this sort of space travel that would be available to more than just the very elite astronauts.
You know, the light from the stars and the planets, it's just amazing. And because we also live in an area where we have the largest protected airspace in the country. I mean, White Sands Missile Range, which is located nearby. So the idea of things shooting up into the air is certainly not foreign at all to us here.
Except, oh, here comes the except part. It hasn't happened yet. No Virgin Galactic spaceflight in 2012 or 2013. There were construction delays, haggles with regulators, insurance problems, political fights. Here's Fred Martino again.
There was some concern at one point that Virgin Galactic was very concerned about its future in New Mexico, and it had to do with the legislation that was being proposed at the state level to give liability protection for the folks who do the launches at the spaceport, build the equipment for the spaceport.
And the spaceport came with a big price tag, more than $200 million, money from the state, the local counties, and their taxpayers. For now, the action at the spaceport is mostly from Elon Musk's company SpaceX and NASA. And there's only one road out there. Josh Wheeler rode the bus to it.
The couple of times that I visited, nothing was happening out there.
Virgin Galactic has said it will stay at Spaceport America, but state officials are no longer counting on the jobs and revenue from those space tourists to make the money back.
They were no longer going to be getting the kind of economic development that comes from being the cradle of a nascent industry. They now had to sort of rely on the promise of tourist boom.
The last time that I looked online, it cost $59 to be able to get a bus ride to go out to see the spaceport. And there is actually no differential in the price. You pay that same price whether you're one of the local taxpayers who every time you buy something, the money, part of that money goes toward the spaceport, or if you're somebody from out of state who's just in town and wants to see this place.
For now, the people New Mexico is relying on to recoup its money are tourists who'll go out to see the spaceport, but never get off the ground.
What New Mexico is really hoping to have is terrestrial space tourists, people who come on the ground to just check out what the other space tourists are doing. It's very ironic, you know, on the one hand you have people who can afford a 250,000 ticket going up into suborbital space and getting these amazing views. And on the other hand, you'll have people who can't afford those tickets who are expected to just come and watch those people who do have that money go and have this great, potentially life-changing experience.
So what's the future? That depends on what Virgin Galactic does next. Richard Branson told the TV network Fusion that he's 90% certain they will launch this year. We reached out to both Virgin Galactic and Spaceport America. As of showtime, we haven't heard back. The World Cup is a big moneymaker. Here's a little slice of that.
My name is Neil Osina. Osina is actually Polish. I've been in business since 1964. This is my 50th anniversary.
50 years of stacks and books and cases and piles of sports memorabilia filling best variety sports cards outside L.A. Up front are two rookie cards, Babe Ruth and Jackie Robinson.
Those two are not for sale. I need the display. I need to be able to have something that I can talk about and show off and impress the kids, kids of all ages.
Now the kids, yeah, of all ages, are buying stickers to fill their Panini World Cup albums. You need 640 to fill the pages with every player from every team.
I heard that Mario Balotelli bought a book, and then he filled the whole thing with Mario Balotelli stickers.
Wow. I don't even know who they are. That's how bad I am when it comes to the players. I could be giving away something worth hundreds.
It's 99 cents a pack for 5 cards.
This is all that I have left. Usually people will buy from 10 to a box.
Tell me about the kids who come in for this.
You know, I've been having, the kids seem to be around 10 to 12 years old, generally. I mean, obviously they're watching the game. They probably have played it in school.
Is it mostly boys?
I guess there are girls, but they haven't come in here yet.
So my godson is 4, and his older brother is 7, and they are really into this.
Wow.
And they do the thing where they open up a pack with their friends, and it's like, well, I've got this one, I need that, you
right?
Need him, got
oh,
him.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Do you see them trade?
Actually, I've had a number of kids come in, and they ask me if I can trade, and I tell them basically that because of the rent I have to pay, I can't really trade, but I know you're going to find lots of friends to trade with. It's just getting so popular in America. You know, it didn't used to be as popular, and now they're playing in school in the middle classes, and it's just coming of age.
And finally, we've been keeping an eye on the marketplace stories that got you talking this week. One of them was Washington reporter David Gura's story about paid family leave and whether the U.S. should mandate it. Right now, the law says you can take 12 weeks off without losing your job, but without pay. A lot of you weighed in on Marketplace's Facebook page and on Twitter about your own experiences and what you think this country should do and who should pay for it. Since David's story struck a chord, we're going to bring him back to tell us some more. Hi, David.
Hey, Lizzie.
So who gets paid leave now in the U.S.?
A very small percentage of workers. If you look at the private sector, it's just around 10% of workers who would get paid leave. As you mentioned, with the Family Medical Leave Act, people who work for companies that have more than 50 employees can get 12 weeks off unpaid. But paid leave is a very rare thing in this country.
We had these comments on Facebook, and one of them was a guy from Alexander saying the problem with giving something, quote, paid is that somebody has to pay for it.
if there were to be an expansion of paid leave, where would the money come from?
There's a proposal on the table in Congress to expand paid leave. It would give you 12 weeks off paid, and that would come out of a payroll tax. And what was really funny about this summit was a lot of people were talking about this issue, about how this issue needs, we need to see things change. The White House hasn't gotten behind a proposal. This proposal in Congress would do that through a payroll tax. And where things get thorny is that during the 2008 campaign, President Obama vowed that he wouldn't raise taxes on Americans who make less than $250,000 a year. If we were to get universal paid leave, that would have to come out of everyone's paycheck.
Happen.
So
yeah.
That's the issue. And that's sort of what was funny about the summit.
One of the things I'm curious about is this question of people who have kids, who don't have kids. People on Facebook were saying, well, wait a minute, what if you don't have kids? Like, can't we all just get more vacation days and paid leave?
It's funny. I talked about that with a couple of people that I interviewed for my piece earlier in the week. And they said, you know, it's the rare American who hasn't had to care for a kid or had to care for a relative. So we tend to think about this in the context of taking care of a newborn, taking care of a kid. But a lot of us will have to field some of the responsibility, some of the cost that comes with taking care of an older relative. So
I was struck
by sort of the big tent nature of this summit. And that was one of the things that the White House really wanted to emphasize, is that paid leave is something, yes, that you use for taking care of a kid, but it's also something that would be useful for taking care of other relatives.
What did you do when your daughter was born?
I took 2 months off. That was unpaid leave. I took some vacation time and some sick time to do that. It was something that I wanted to do, that I was eager to do. But I was definitely the exception among my friends in being able to do that and doing it. It's not the easiest thing to go 2 months without getting a paycheck, having a job and having gotten one. So I'm happy that I did it, but it certainly wasn't totally easy to do.
What happens next in all of this? Is this really going to happen, or is this a DC promise?
I think it's the latter. You know, I think that one utility of this summit was it got people talking about the issue. I think that's something that the White House wants. They're focusing on what they call these kitchen table issues. But as I mentioned, there's this bill on the Hill that doesn't appear to be going anywhere. I think the folks who authored that bill would like nothing more than for the White House to get behind it. The White House is certainly happy to trumpet the fact that this is something they're talking about. But look, it's been 5.5 years since President Obama got into office, and this really hasn't been something where we've seen a lot of real action since.
Look into your notebook for me. Is there something in your reporting on all this that surprised you?
I think it's the figures. I mean, you started off asking me about how many people in this country get paid leave, and it really is a small percentage. And when you sort of pull it apart and look at, you know, what people get in other countries, we do stand out. I think you can sort of recognize that no matter where you stand on the political spectrum. The U.S. is an outlier when it comes to leave.
What are you working on next week? What's ahead for you?
I'm starting to dig into the culture of campaign finance, sort of look at why people give and the ways they give, looking at through this framework of the return on investment that we donate to a candidate for a reason. You want to get something out of it, and you can be really cynical about that or, you know, very earnest about it as well. I'm going to look at a new phenomenon now that's sort of on the rise, actually, in California. People who are going to political consultants to help them decide where they should give money, to what candidates, to what committees, to what nonprofits. So it's called donor-side political management, and I'll have a feature on that next week.
David Gura, our Washington reporter. Thanks so much, David.
Thanks, Lizzie.
That's Marketplace Weekend for this week. So next week, we'll have some brunch and hear where you got tripped up by the fine print. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan, John Sepulvedo, and Candice Manriquez. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer and poker ace. Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music was composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. And I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We'll see you again next weekend. This is APM.